Talk given Sunday, 14th September, 1980.
It's when
you're
in heaven.
Ah, yes, yes.
You can't get any truth in that.
The statement, marriages were made in heaven, is a very, very profound statement, actually, telling us something very deep about our own selves. Psychologists and most people actually do know that man is dual. A female body has a male animus, as they call it. A male body has a female anima. Now this is the earthly androgyne. Man, woman together like that. No separation between them. The male, female, the positive, negative. We call an androgyne. Now, corresponding to that, in each human being, this is the old teaching from the Veda and the Kabbalah. There is also the divine androgyne, you see. And the question arises, what is this divine androgyne? Just let me read to you from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad what is said about this. No, don't get up. The teaching of the Kabbalah is rather more subtle. We'll go into that in a few moments. But here it is in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. This is from the first chapter, the fourth section, and the fifth portion of it has this, the third portion rather, has this statement. Verily he had no delight. He is referring to the original creator of the universe as such. I better read it from the beginning. In the beginning, this world was Atma alone in the form of a person. Looking around, he saw nothing else than himself. He said first, I am. Thence arose the name I. Therefore, even today, when one is addressed, he says first, just, it is I, and then speaks whatever name he has. I think normally we would say, it's me. Since before, previously, all this world he burned up, he burned up all evils, therefore he is a person, Purusha. He who knows this verily burns up him who desires to be ahead of him. It's a curious statement. But let me explain it in a little more detail. The word Purusha, which means a person, is the origin of this term is indicated here. Since before all this world, and the word for before is purva, P-U-R-V-A, Purva. He burned up all evils. That I consider an incomplete translation, because the Sanskrit word which is translated as evils is papa manam. Now the word papa means sin, or if you like, evil, you see. And manam is mind. I've noticed that practically all the translators have just ignored the manam part. But this is the really important part. He burnt up all evil-mindedness. Now that makes throws a completely new light upon the situation. And the word for burn, the Sanskrit root is ush. So before pur is taken from purva, and ush from and usha comes from ush, you see. So you get purusha. So that means that the potentiality within each and every one of us is to burn up all evil-mindedness. And to understand it this way is of tremendous significance where the total discipline of the religious life is concerned. You've got the whole secret there. The burning up of all evil-mindedness in ourselves. And it is said, this is said, of the origin of all things. In the beginning, this world was Atma alone, in the form of a person. Now, this person, this Purusha, is said to have burned up all evil-mindedness. But in the beginning really means that a person, you or I, in the profoundest meditative condition, realized the total unity of the universe. Consciousness was not a separative consciousness. It was aware of the one total reality, which is the whole thing, transcendence itself. Now, why does the writer of this start by saying in the form of a person? Because ultimately, as far as thought can go, whatever is realized in the innermost depths of consciousness cannot get past the fact that oneself is a person. See? Oneself is a person. And so you have the whole of that. Then I'll skip the second one. The third one, verily he had no delight. Therefore, one alone has no delight. He desired a second. He was indeed as large as a woman and a man closely embraced. He caused that self to fall into two pieces. The Sanskrit root of the word, of the verb fall, is pat, P-A-T, pat, you see, to fall into two pieces. Therefrom arose a husband, pati, and a wife, patni. They were originally just non-dual, just one. A man and a woman, a masculine and feminine, a positive and a negative energy in close embrace. And he caused this to fall apart. And thereby arose the divine androgyne. That was the divine androgyne. And this is the marriage made in heaven, which cannot be separated at all. Our task is so to live and so to purify ourselves as the earthly androgyne, the masculine, feminine, the feminine, masculine in us, that the divine androgyne once again functions freely. So this is how the Veda presents it. Now, in the Kabbalistic teachings, you know how they talk about the emanations out of the Supreme Yahweh, that emanating himself at his own divine level, first there came wisdom, Chokhmah, and second there came Bina, intelligence. Now, Bina holds within herself both the positive and negative energies, the male and the female. Chokhmah, wisdom, just by virtue of presence, the very presence of wisdom, so stimulates Bina that the whole evolutionary process starts up and the universe comes into being. You have a similar presentation in the Sankhya philosophy of India, in addition to this, you see, where we talk of Prakruti as primordial nature, which holds in quiescence, inactivity still, both the positive and the negative elements which produce the universe, the male and the female. Prakruti, primordial nature. And this, these two energies, the masculine and the feminine, which are present there, stimulated by Purusha, the person, the supreme person, starts up all the process by which the material universe and human beings and the spiritual universe all comes into being. This is how they present it, you see. So you see the similarity of the presentation in the philosophies of India with the Kabbalah, which is of course the origin of the Judeo-Christian traditions. Now, in Genesis, you get this partly told. If you look at Genesis carefully, you will find that first, the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God wishing to find someone who was a suitable mate for Adam, caused a sleep to fall upon Adam. That means that Adam, a man, this is again the story of ourselves, this person, entering the deep states of consciousness, goes beyond that stage where all thought ceases. All thought and conceptualizing ceases altogether, you see. And the Lord God takes a rib out of Adam, as it is said, and fashions that rib into the woman. Now, the original statement is, Esha is the woman in the Kabbalistic teaching. Esha. And the name Esha means the daughter of Esh. Esh is the creative fire, by way, means of which Elohim is the real creator God. Elohim produces the entire universe. You see? The word Elohim is made up of two parts, Ele and Mi, M-I-Mi. Ele, E-L-E-H, means the eternal what. And Mi means the eternal who. the eternal who and the eternal what interacting with each other constitute this the Elohim. All these words are translated simply as God in the English language, and it's the same with the other languages too, French or German, which is rather a troublesome thing. They ought to have the original Hebrew word also. This interaction then Elohim is the power which utilizes creative energy. Elohim itself is creative energy, and consists of a male and a female aspect as such in action. And Elohim produces the world, and Elohim says, let us create man in our own living likeness. Now the usual translation in the Bible is, and God said, let us make man in our own image. A translation which I don't like at all. Because when you talk of making, it's like us on the human plane, in our ordinary everyday life. We make a piano or whatever we manufacture and so on, we make, you see. But this is quite different. What need has Elohim to make things in that sense? So I prefer to have it translate it as, an Elohim, let us create man in our own living likeness. An image is something dead, isn't it? But to create man in our own living likeness shows the intimate relationship, the intimate link between the supreme creative energy of the universe and ourselves as such, you see? And therefore, the relationship is a complete and a whole relationship, materially as well as spiritually. Because matter is the concretest expression of this supreme creative energy at work. And what we call spirit is the most subtle expression of this same creative energy. If one sees these things, one wakes up in inner awareness to the unity of the universe, to the one total reality in which there is no sundering, no splitting up, you see. So now, Esha is the woman in the first, second, and third chapters of Genesis, I think. Now you get the so-called temptation, the serpent. And he's a talking serpent. Actually, Nahash is the Hebrew word for the serpent, Nahash. Actually, this word represents the life force. That's the subtle serpent, the life force itself. And you know how it was said to Adam that you may eat of all the fruit in the Garden of Eden, but if you eat of this, the fruit of this particular tree, you will surely die. You see? Now nothing of that sort does happen when that fruit is eaten. Now, well, what is this Garden of Eden? People, of course, try to place it in the Euphrates-Tigris region. because the word Euphrates comes in talking of the four rivers that go out of Eden. The Garden of Eden is your own psychophysical organism. This is the Garden of Eden for each one of us as an individual human being. You see? And on the large scale, that is to say the scale which involves the whole of humanity, the whole earth is the Garden of Eden. So our own psychophysical organism, as well as the whole world, is our Garden of Eden. You may eat of the fruit of any tree. All these trees, what are all these trees? They are our sense functions which enable all different kinds of impressions to come to us, become synthesized by the activity of the brain, which uses our faculty of speech to name them, you see? And out of that arises our whole ordinary psycho-mental life, with this naming process. Right. Now, when the life force stimulates Asia, wants to stimulate Asia, it puts before Asia the statement that, did the Lord God really say that you would die? She says, yes, that's what we were told. And the life force, the serpent, says, no, you will surely be like Elohim if you eat of this fruit. Now, what is this fruit and what is this tree? Now, bear in mind that as the translations stand, the tree of good and evil, the knowledge of good and evil, not good and evil in the actual event sense of events or conditions which are good and evil, but the knowledge of the good and evil is in the middle of the Garden of Eden. And also the tree of life is in the middle of this same garden. Now consider, here is this garden, the psychophysical organism. You see? How can you have two trees in the same place, in the middle of the garden? What is this tree? This tree of life, let us start with. The Ashwatha tree, as presented in the Hindu teachings, the Upanishadic as well as the Gita. The Ashwatha tree, as it is called. And of course, all the clever scholars have identified it with the Ficus religiosa and so forth. But you can forget what the great scholars have done. Let us try and see a little more deeply into it. Now, this tree in the midst of the garden is your brain and nervous system, the spine, you see, and the activity of the ductless glands particularly. This is the tree. The tree of life. Your brain, it's your spine, and your brain and nervous system. That is the tree of life. Now, Asha looks upon the tree and sees that it is very attractive and good to eat. She stretches forth her hand and eats of it. Now, remember that her origin actually is immortal. You see? Elohim himself, the Lord God himself, takes a rib and creates Asha. That's only a symbolic way, a poetic way of expressing this process of emanation out of the Supreme Being as such, as presented in the Kabbalah. So she cannot die in any case. And in any case, the interdiction that thou shalt not eat of this tree was given to Adam, not to the woman. That's a point which everybody seems to miss. It wasn't given to the woman. Well, this is the divine woman, remember. She's the embodiment of Bina, which is part and parcel of the very constitution of the Lord God. And so she likes it and gives the fruit, the ripe fruit, to Adam. Now, what is the fruit of the tree of life? Consciousness. Consciousness is the fruit. And that fruit in its ripeness is the pure consciousness of the perfected Holy One. This was the rather symbolic way in which these people were taught these profound truths about themselves, about their own nature, about the potentiality within them, and so forth. You see? Now, when Adam eats of this fruit, something rather drastic happens to him. Because the ripe fruit is pure consciousness, which is the divine consciousness itself. There is no evil-mindedness possible in that consciousness. You see, it's the perfect consciousness. Very good. Adam takes of it. But what does the name Adam mean? He of the ground. That is one meaning, out of the ground. He who came out of the ground, was made out of the ground, created out of the ground. Now the ground here must not be understood merely as what we call ground with regard to the earth on which we walk. The ground, you know the phrase, the ground of all things means the origin of all things, the source of all things. And that is Elohim himself. You see, or Yahweh Elohim himself. That is one meaning of Adam, which indicates also his potentiality, what could be with him, what could happen through him and in him and through him. The flowering of the supreme consciousness, the perfect consciousness, so that the ultimate meditative state would be a constant state in which he dwelt. But there is another meaning of Adam, the word Adam. If you take the first letter, A in English, Aleph in the Hebrew, Aleph stands for the creative power itself, the supreme creative power, the supreme energy. And Dam means a bag of blood. It means blood. The creative power in the blood, so to say. That's what Adam means. But Adam, the earthy man, is not yet fit. He hasn't developed sufficiently to take the infusion, this injection of this tremendous divine energy into him. So what happens to him is that instead of realizing pure consciousness straight away, there was no problem where Esha was concerned about it, because she is already from the divine source. But with Adam, what happens is that the consciousness which arises in him and which comes into activity when he wakes up out of his sleep is what we call discriminative consciousness, vijnana. That's what happened to him. He's like a man who sort of got a blow on his head with a knobkerrie, And the poor chap was quite confused and in a dizzy state. Something which I speak of from experience. You see, he was knocked on the head with an upgeri and he was in a dizzy state. And he couldn't quite make out what was what. So what developed in him was discriminative consciousness. Now what does discriminative consciousness do? It divides, it analyzes, it splits up. You see? And this dividing the unity, trying to divide the one unity of the universe into separate bits, is the fundamental meaning of the word sin. So this is why it was called the original sin. And Adam gets driven out of Eden. Then afterwards Eve comes on the scene. Eve is the female body, you see, who is the earthly representative. She also evolves out of the earth as such. She doesn't have a divine source. She evolves out of the earth, which is a physical fact. We all know that. Men and women in the world, right to this day, are born in a certain way and are men and women as such. And then they pair up to form the earthly androgyne. So when a man and a woman marry, the animus and anima also wed, actually, as well as the bodies. The bodies can be separated. But what about the psyches? In a curious way, once a man and a woman have joined in sexual congress, as long as they live, they cannot completely throw out the psychical interfusion which has taken place. It has its effect for the rest of one's life. It is for this reason that sexual purity has been emphasized so very strongly in the religious teachings. Because it's just good sense and good psychology to understand this, and therefore be very careful about choosing one's partners and so forth. All this comes in. Two psyches cannot be divorced. Two bodies can. I'm sorry if it touches any unhappy spot in people when they hear this sort of thing. So now, our task, here as we are, functioning as mainly as the earthly androgyne, is so to deal with ourselves that all evil-mindedness is burnt out. If and when all evil-mindedness is burnt out, then one has become the perfected Holy One and the divine androgyne functions freely through one. So you get the manifestation of of transcendent love and transcendent wisdom in the same person. Mahakaruna functions, and Mahakaruna is the woman part, the feminine part, and Mahaprajna is the masculine part in operation through the perfected Holy One, the enlightened one, if you like to say so. But you see, the sad thing in our lives is that these things are unknown to the world as a whole. There are only a few who know about this, And there is no value in knowing about it unless one aspires to, as well as has the capacity to fulfill it. We may aspire to the most perfect things, the beautiful things, but if we haven't got the capacity, we can't do it, you see. It's like a person who feels, I'd like to be one of the finest concert pianists of the world. He really has a passion to become the great concert pianist, but somehow nature hasn't gifted him sufficiently to get to that stage. You know, after all, there was only one Homer and one Shakespeare, one Beethoven, one Bach. There weren't dozens of them. That is how things are. And we have to accept that fact and therefore not suffer in the wrong way from unnecessary remorse with respect to the past. Well, it has happened this way. It may have happened fortunately and happily, or there may have been difficulties, problems, which necessitated a rearrangement of real relationships. But it is wise, in the state of rearranged relationships, to bear in mind that the psychical influence can never be discarded altogether. If one goes into it in the quiet of one's mind very carefully and with deep understanding, the ill effects are all transmuted into a richer and a more fulfilled relationship in connection with that which is actually present now. There is always redemption, whatever the ill may have been. Always there is redemption. Because there is the actuality of this transcendent divine love sustaining everything and everywhere. And the common garden saying, love heals all things and all sorrow and so forth. Well, of course it does. But we have to have the ability to let that medicine work. If, after all, you suggest a medicine, if I don't take it, what can happen? I will remain in my ill state, won't I? That is why the relationship between the one who is able to impart some knowledge of these deep things and the person or persons who receive these deep things, the relationship is a very special one altogether. It is one which enables the dormant divinity within us to come to fruition. And it can come to full fruition, to such full fruition that a phenomenon like the perfected Holy One, the enlightened one, the one who is regarded as the living God on earth, you see, all that can happen. So then he is called the Son of God. In some traditions, he's called the Brahmaputra in other traditions. I don't know whether you know that the Buddha openly says that he is a Brahman. And that is something which conventional orthodox Buddhism glosses over, doesn't take notice of that statement. But I'll show you. Here is the statement by the Buddha. It comes in the Samyutta Nikaya, the fifth volume, fifth section. It is possible, Ananda, to lay down in this Dhamma discipline a procedure towards Brahma. And Brahma, just B-R-A-H-M-A, pronounced like that, Brahma, is the same as Brahman, the absolute all, the totality. I'll use the word Brahman because then it won't confuse us with Brahma, the creator God. You see, the first person of the later Hindu Trinity. This Ananda is a synonym for the Aryan Eightfold Way, Brahman, the word. Procedure towards Brahman, also procedure towards Dhamma, also the matchless victory in the struggle. I mean, people talk about Buddhism as a despairing religion, there's no hope and so forth. They're talking through the soles of their shoes, not even through their hats. Then there's another statement. It comes in the Itivuttaka, one of the minor, so-called minor texts. I, O monks, am a Brahman. Now this is the Brahman caste. Brahman in the sense of the Brahman caste. The people of the Brahman caste call themselves Brahmins without being true Brahmins. I, monks, am a Brahman. One to ask a favor from, that is to say, one from whom anybody else could ask a favor. One to ask a favor from, ever pure-handed, bearer of my last body, matchless physician and surgeon. You are my own true sons, born of my mouth, born of Dhamma, formed by Dhamma, heirs of Dhamma, not heirs of material things. Now there's a tremendous wealth of stuff here. If you study the Upanishads carefully, especially the so-called minor Upanishads, they include the Yoga Upanishads as well as Upanishads which are dedicated to the worship of Shiva or of Vishnu as such, you see. The term in the Vajrasuchi Upanishad, it is distinctly stated that quite irrespective of the social meaning of the word caste, you see that you belong to this caste or that caste, whoever your parents were, however you were born, if you live the religious life and become the purified holy one, the really perfected one, then you are a Brahman. Now, why was that stated? Way back in the Rig Veda, I could lay my hands on it at once, but let's not waste time. Take my word for it. It is there. It's in the tenth book of the Rig Veda. It is stated, the hymn states that the Brahman is born out of the mouth of Brahma, of Brahman, the supreme creative energy, born of his mouth. The Kshatriya, the warrior and the administrator, was born of his arms. That's it, arms. That's the word I want. Born of his arms. The Vaishya, the shopkeeper, etc., was born out of his belly, and the Shudra, the worker, was born out of Brahma's legs and feet, you see. But they were all born out of the one body of the Supreme itself. Therefore, no one is really higher or lower. They are all indispensable for the running of the total universe, so to say. All these groups of people. And so in the Vajrasuchi Upanishad, the Brahman was born of his mouth, his word. And you know, in the beginning was the word, and the word is the creative, represents the creative power. That is to say, not words of our language, but whatsoever sound is produced in such a way that its vibration stimulates you to the Supreme, that's a creative vibration. You know, great music, or any and a person singing wonderfully, or a bird singing may affect you in such a way as to turn you towards the Supreme. So now, we come back to the divine, to the marriage made in heaven. This refers to the divine marriage, and that is embodied in us. That is embodied in us. We consist of two androgynes, each one of us. The divine androgyne indicating our supreme potentiality, because when the two elements of wisdom and of intelligence stimulate, when wisdom stimulates this intelligence, then that is the primordial marriage made in heaven. And our earthly marriages are also derived and intended to be earthly replicas, representations, representations of the divine marriage. That's why marriage is such a wonderful and a sacred thing, if people only understood it. I mean, I suppose the modern world could dispense with 99% of its miseries if the man-woman relationship were truly understood and put into practice.
May I ask a question?
Yes, do.